Good morning, Arizona homeowners. Welcome to hour number two of Rosie on the House. It's the 8 o'clock hour. It's the outdoor living hour. And as we go around back here, Mr. Jay Harper's out in the field, and he's already sweating. It's 8 o'clock in the morning, and he looks like he's been out here for hours.
Not sweating as bad as if you wait a few more hours, you're going to be this weekend and into early next week. We're going to have, even us native Arizonans would call it hot. You know, when it's the one teens, it's just, there's no couch in it, it's hot. But, you know, the mornings aren't too bad, and get out and get your work done before it gets brutal. But make sure you're drinking plenty of water and got a good hat and some sunscreen, and make sure you're watering those plants, too.
Yeah, they're the ones that have to sit out there all day in this heat.
That's right. So this is, we've been harping on people to check those irrigation systems. And, man, if you've got any inconsistencies or parts of your system that aren't working quite right, you're probably going to discover it in the wrong fashion by about mid next week, because a day or two of over 115 degrees with a water system that's not functioning, or if you're not running it correctly, plants are going to get stressed.
And stress, they're droopy, they're wilty. How long can they go before they're too far to save?
Well, it depends on the plant. So that's a good reason to plant heat-tolerant, drought-resistant plants, is they can withstand periods of stress, high heat, lack of water, better than plants that aren't as adapted to our area. So if you've got young bedding plants, or maybe your garden vegetables like tomatoes and those things, you know, they're probably, you know, if they're wilted and they go another day, they're going to be damaged beyond the point of being able to recoup. So in some cases, it's just a matter of a few hours if they go past to that, what I call the point of no return, when the wilt is so heavy and then damage starts occurring because the tissue is completely dehydrated, it gets desiccated, it starts drying out, then there's no hydrating it any longer. The roots start to damage, the mechanisms that pump water out of the ground up into the leaves, the vascular system of the plant, so to speak, has been damaged to the point where it can't, it just doesn't work. So again, things, obviously vegetative things, herbal things, herbs, vegetable plants, soft annuals, they're going to be the first things to show up. Turf, grasses, you'll have brown spots in your lawn in just a matter of a day or two. They can't go that long. So you get into things like Mexican Bird of Paradise and Lantana and Bougainvilleas and those real heat-tolerant plants, you know, they'll withstand a day or two of wilt and stress before they start to show any signs of damage.
Every summer we get calls from people that have got this tree and they've got a well and they're watering it with a hose and it's on it for 20 minutes and they can't understand why doing that every day the tree's not right. Tree's not surviving. How is every day not enough?
Well, it's all about how deep you're watering and how deep you're getting the water to penetrate into the soil. So it's kind of a 1-2-3, if you can think of it that way. So things like ground covers and annuals and bedding plants and tomatoes and garden plants, if you can get them wet a foot deep, or the soil to have moisture in it about a foot deep, then they'll go several days between waterings. If you've got regular landscape shrubs, vines, hedges, shrubbery, general shrubbery, 2 feet deep is generally adequate. And then trees, about 3 feet deep. So if you water a tree in a little well and you run the water, generally people that do that run it pretty fast, and we just kind of fill that well up. And if you've got 6 or 8 inches of standing water there before it starts to percolate down into the ground, you're probably only getting water down 6 inches to a foot deep. So about a third as deep as you need to. And that's the thing where people don't understand. It's not a matter of how fast you can fill that well up, but really about how much water you can put on the plant to get it totally wet. The entire canopy of the plant, whether it's a tomato plant or a Texas sage or a big mesquite tree, from tip to tip to the proper depth, and you will have a healthy plant, and it won't stress out at all, probably, in periods of high heat. Now, I always use the 110 degrees as my rule of thumb. When I've got my summer watering schedule figured out, when it goes above 110, I generally throw the schedule out. You just got to start watching them then. You may have the perfect water system and you're watering 3 feet deep and you're giving those plants a nice deep. They probably need an extra watering when we receive, especially when we have temperatures that exceed that for several days in a row.
We've got a great program this hour lined up. It's 1-888-767-4348. That's 1-888-ROSIE for you to join the conversation. You can text questions to 411-923 or email info@rosieonthehouse.com if you've got a question about plant or insect identification, which actually kind of rolls into one of the questions we got here this week from Susan in the 857, so somewhere in Tucson, Southern Arizona, is dealing with mosquitoes in their house, on the back porch. Most garden centers carry types of mosquito killers or repellents. What would be your plan of attack for her?
Well, first of all, probably try and figure out what the source of the mosquitoes is. So you might have some standing water, might have a water feature, a pond, a bird bath. Maybe you've got a wet spot in the grass that is staying wet because you have maybe a bad solenoid or a bad valve, so that's not shutting off all the way and you got kind of a wet spot. So those mosquitoes are breeding somewhere, and it may not be in your yard. It may be in the neighbor or behind you, or, you know, so maybe check around and ask around. Then there's lots of things that you can try, from planting things like basil and citronella and rosemary, some scented herbal kind of plants, which will do a pretty good job, lavender, of repelling mosquitoes in small areas. We just looked at a product the other day that our friends at Ewing Irrigation brought to us, and it's part of a low-voltage lighting system, and there's a little compartment that goes on that system, and you put mosquito repellent in it, and as it, you know, it, so it kind of emits some odor that is a repellent to the mosquitoes. Obviously, citronella candles people have used over the years, or tiki torches, those sorts of things. There's some different lotions you can put on yourself, spraying yourself down, all of those things. A fan, keep the air moving. There's a number of things that it takes a combination of all of those things to really be effective.
Now, another great question we received just now, Robert was listening. Obviously, the watering is very important, but what about fertilizing right now, especially for anything in bloom? In this stress situation, is it worth fertilizing or is it too hot to fertilize?
That's a great question because we get that all the time. People think it's too hot. Now, if your plant has gotten stressed and it's suffering and it's wilting and got burned leaves, you probably don't want to fertilize it right away. We want to correct the situation, get the watering system right, make sure the plant has recovered, and then we want to start feeding again. But a well-fertilized or well-nourished plant will also withstand periods of drought better and heat and stress better. So yes, this is generally when plants are the most active and growing. If you're looking for something that is more for blooming plants, then you want to pick something that's maybe higher in phosphorus, which is the middle number of our three numbers on every fertilizer. Every fertilizer has to have some type of guaranteed analysis. The first number is nitrogen, second is phosphorus, and the third is potassium or potash. That middle number is what generally is responsible for helping promote blooms within a plant. So a rose food would generally have a higher middle number than a first or a last number. Rose food's kind of a good catch-all for most blooming plants that we don't always have a bougainvillea food or a lantana food or something. Use some rose food. It'll work really well.
And for most homeowners, you're a fan of the granular over the liquid.
For most cases, yes, except for maybe pots, indoor plants, those types of things. And quite frankly, I don't know that I'm lazy, but maybe I'm forgetful. It's hard to remember to use liquid or soluble fertilizers as often as they need to be used. Granular fertilizers and or slower release fertilizers that you don't have to do as often, I think, are much more effective. They also give the plant a much longer, more even fertilizing than a fast, quick dose of nutrients like a liquid fertilizer does.
But in a case where somebody may have even forgot to put a granular on, can you use the liquid to give it a quick juice and then shortly after start with the granule to get it back up?
Great idea. To get it a boost, to give it a kickstart, some liquid is a great way to go, and then back it up behind it another week or two with a granular, a slow release, or especially an organic type fertilizer would work great.
Now, could we apply that same technique to a lawn? Is there a liquid lawn fertilizer you could go out there and spray and follow with a granular?
Well, there is. There are some liquid lawn foods. Actually, there's ones that come in a little deal that screw right on the end of your garden hose. And you can go out there and give them a good feeding. Sometimes those are good little touch-ups in between. But for lawns, I'm really a big fan of slower-release fertilizers because lawns are growing fast. You're cutting them all the time, pruning them. They're recovering. So they need that constant supply of nutrients there that an organic or a slow-release lawn food will supply. And summertime is really when, you know, our summer lawns, we grow lawns year-round here, but your Bermuda grasses, your summer or heat-tolerant lawns are growing like crazy, and the hotter it gets, the faster they grow. So they've got to be fertilized through the hot summer months.
And I've heard you never want to mow more than a third of the length of the grass at a time. If you're gone for a couple weeks, raise your blade up, cut it, wait a couple days, and cut it. You never want to do more than a third cutting at a time. Is that
good rule of thumb? If you take more than a third off, especially in hot weather, you're going to scalp the lawn, scald it. It's going to turn brown. That stresses it out, and it makes it harder for the lawn to recover.
And how much, for anyone that might be new, because I know we've covered this plenty, how many inches of Bermuda of water? Let me start that again. How many inches of water per week does the average Bermuda lawn need?
Well, somewhere between 2 and 4 inches. Two's kind of just an acceptable lawn. 4 inches is going to give you a pretty lush lawn. So got to get the tuna cans out there, measure your sprinkler output, and then do the math over the course of a 7-day period, you know, somewhere in that 2 to 4 inch range.
On a beautiful Arizona Saturday morning, happy Father's Day weekend to you all. Our product partners have put together some great giveaways. We're going to do another one right now. We've got so many to give away, we're not going to do anything fancy. It's just going to be, we're going to do text this time. This one is a Hex Armor. It's a 3-in-1 here. You're going to get Hex Armor tinted safety glasses, Hex Armor Rig Lizard gloves. These are their warm weather impact gloves, very breathable. And you're going to get a Grill Bot. This is an automatic cleaner for your grill. Just text FATHER to 411-923 between now and the end of the segment, and everyone that texts in will just pick at random. So FATHER to 411-923 will draw a random winner for the Grill Bot gloves and the Hex Armor glasses. We're in the Outdoor Living Hour right now with Jay Harper of Harper's Nursery. At the National Hardware Show, we've had a lot of fun with this, and there's a lot of new and great tools. So let's play a little game. We'll go through your top 5 tools every gardener must have, and I'll let you know the newest or the most American-made in those brands.
Well, the first thing that I think of, because probably use it the most, is a pair of hand pruners.
Pruners. And do you have one particular that y'all like or sell?
We sell Corona, typically. I grew up selling Corona. We still sell Corona.
My clippers, my saw, my pruner, my hedger, any hand cutter or saw is Corona. Not all of Corona is American made, but they're out of Corona, California. So it's an American based company anyway.
Correct. They have a pretty good guarantee, warranty on their products. And they've just got a lot of different options. and they're fairly reasonably priced. I mean, you can spend a lot more on a pruner, and if you're a professional and doing pruning, there might be other pruners that are more well suited to you.
And you can pick them up at Ewing. You can pick them up at Sprinkler World. You can pick them up anywhere they sell landscape products.
Pretty much most landscape stores, nurseries, garden centers, lawnmower repair shops. Scotty's carries a lot of Corona. So there's Corona, most professional type shops.
Now, they don't exhibit at the National Hardware Show, but I tell you, pruners is one thing you don't see a lot there of. In fact, I couldn't tell you one person I can recall that exhibit pruners. Maybe that's just such a common thing. They don't need to go and be out in front of new retailers. They're
probably
there.
Probably not a lot of new technology in pruners, although I will say the new battery-powered, I guess for lack of the rechargeable power tool pruners on the pole pruners, wow, they're pretty slick.
Briggs & Stratton has one, the Snap. It's their snapper line at 82-volt battery.
That'll get
it
done.
That's some power. All right, so hand pruners is number one. What would number two?
A good leaf rake.
Okay. Again, not one that there's a lot, not new technology in leaf rakes.
Probably not. You know, we've gone through phases where we went from, you know, metal to a lot of plastic at one time. Now, you know, everybody's kind of back to metal, fiberglass handled versus wood handled, you know, those types of things. But, you know, it's pretty hard to do much yard work without a leaf rake.
I do look for the fiberglass a lot. Even out of the shade, if you don't have an air conditioned space for the wood, man, that the sap and everything just dries up and it shrinks and it starts to deteriorate.
Yeah. They really do.
Number three?
Gloves.
Gloves. Oh. Now, there must have been 20 different glove manufacturers at the National Hardware Show. Do you have a particular favorite? Or what do you look for when you're getting gloves? Do you just go to the traditional old leather hide?
I hate wearing gloves.
Me too. I like to feel my
fingertips. I'll be completely honest with you. I very seldom wear gloves. When I do, I really prefer a cotton glove that just fits, doesn't have the big bulky fingers like most leather gloves do. I'm not a huge fan of the real tight coated, rubbery coated gloves. Just a basic cotton jersey kind of a glove is generally what I wear.
And we do have a few gloves from Hex Armor. They've made the Thorn Armor one, the cactus proof gloves.
Yes.
Now, if I'm working on cactus or trimming ironwoods or mesquites or Palo Verdes, when I'm at least picking them up and moving them, I'll put those on.
Yeah, and here in the summertime, it's hard not to wear gloves just because you mentioned things are hot, you know, so you wear them more to so you can actually pick something up. the thorn-proof type gloves are very practical here in the desert. We have a lot of stuff that's got a lot of thorns and pointy things on it.
Number four?
A good old digging shovel, spade, garden spade, a good one, you know, that you can actually, you know, we have hard ground here. So you're actually standing on that thing trying to get a hole dug.
And for that, we're actually working to bring Ames into the Rosie East store. It's the third oldest company in America, second oldest in, or the oldest in the tool department. And they make all of their spades right here in America. So it's they had a fabulous story. We featured them a few months ago. But the Ames Garden Spade. Number five.
A hat.
Gotta have a hat.
You know, I guess that's part with my fair skin, pretty important. Hat, maybe I should say hat and clothing, all in one statement. So proper garden clothing and a hat included in that.
Now, I do wear baseball caps regularly, but if I'm outside and especially if I'm gardening, I mean, it's got to be a hat that covers ears. I put my cowboy hat on.
No, I mean a hat. It's a big old floppy or a big straw cowboy type hat.
All right, so there's five must-haves for your gardener. It'd be a perfect opportunity to gift idea if you're looking for a Father's Day idea and yours doesn't have those five necessities. You can you got your shopping list for the weekend now.
There you go.
We'll be back.
Sign up for the Rosie on the House weekly newsletter. It's filled with timely gardening and home improvement advice, as well as special offers and discounts you can't find anywhere else. That's rosieonthehouse.com.
Father's Day to you, Arizona homeowner. We had 141 texts for the prize giveaway. If your number starts in 520 and ends in 712, congratulations. You are lucky gift winner number two. If that's not your number, don't worry. We still have four more opportunities to win coming up. We'll do two in the next hour and two in the 10 o'clock hour. One of those includes a Briggs & Stratton 2000 PSI pressure washer. That's a value of about $150. So nice little Father's Day gift there. If you heard the 7 o'clock hour last week, we had a special guest in Kimes Ranch. And they are a local apparel manufacturer. They make Western clothing, and their jeans are American-made. Their cotton comes from a company out of the Carolinas called Cone. It's all assembled, sewn, and put together in L.A., and it's sold here locally. And when Amanda Kimes was in, I said, you know, we have a lot of cotton in Arizona. Why don't Do y'all ever use Arizona cotton? And she kind of said, oh, I hadn't really thought about that. And so I started looking around. I'm like, well, how do we connect the locally grown cotton with the locally owned jean company called Kevin Rogers, who I accidentally misspoke. He is still the president of the Arizona Farm Bureau Association. He thought he was going to have to step down to run for national, but he did not. All that said, he's still hanging up his 14 or 15 year reign as the Farm Bureau president in November. And he said, you know what, Romy, I could talk to you about that, but I'd rather you talk to this other gentleman. He's the current president of the Arizona Cotton Growers Association. He's a, well, I won't go through everything. I'll let Paco tell you about that. We have Mr. Paco Alteron. Did I get that right?
It's Allerton.
Allerton. You made me say it four times yesterday, too, and I still got it wrong.
That's all right, Romy.
Well, thanks for taking time out of your Saturday morning. Let's first start with a little introduction to your family and your family's history here in Arizona.
Okay. My family migrated down here from Utah. My grandfather moved into the area back in the early 1900s, and started to farm in South Tempe. My grandfather went off and was actually a mechanic in the Army Air Corps, World War One. My father was born in Tempe. He flew. He was a fighter pilot in World War Two. After World War Two, he came back, and he and his brother and his father migrated into the Maricopa area. Farmed there, Stanfield, and then branched out into Eloy. And then I came back about 38 years ago and started farming again myself. I'd been on the farm and off the farm over the course of my life, but I've been back for 37, 38 years.
And when you said you came back, were you in the service as well? Your grandfather was served in World War One.
No, I wasn't in the service. I just... No, I went off and I worked a couple other jobs, went to school, worked a couple of jobs, gained some management experience, business experience, great assets.
And came back to the family farm. And what a great 100 years of growing cotton in Arizona, y'all. So I understand now why Kevin said you really need to talk to the Alteron. Yeah. So Arizona Farm Bureau attributes the agricultural industry to over $17 billion. What percentage of that is cotton?
Well, and it's going to vary from year to year, and I've got some numbers from last year's crop, and it's a little bit over $100 million, between $100 and $110 million. Direct revenues between cotton sales and cotton seed sales. Cotton's kind of a unique crop in the fact that it produces cotton seed, which you can use for cattle feed. It's an oil seed. You can crush it for oil, use it for cooking. And then it also produces fiber. And that's what we're really here to talk about today is the fiber. So between the two different products there, the seed and the lint, in 16, and acres were down quite a bit. They fluctuated because the price of cotton the last 5 or 6 years always have, but other crops have been more desirable to grow because of the prices, and cotton was down last year, and it's back up a little bit this year, and hopefully the market will come back and it'll get a little bit stronger going into 18 and 19.
Now, this is your 37th year as growing cotton. How long does it take from seed to harvest?
Oh, roughly about a 6 to 7 or 8 month process. It depends on where you are. If we start planting in the central part of the state in early to mid-March, and it'll be harvested in October, November, December. You go to the western part of the state, and they start a little bit earlier. They'll start planting in 1st of February, and their crop will come off in August, and even some of it will be as late as October, November. So it's about a 6 to 7, 8 month crop time frame from plant to harvest.
And what's a good yield of your cotton per acre? What are you looking to accomplish?
We kind of manage our crop to try to get a 3+ bale crop, and our state average is right about 3 bales. And when I talk about 3 bales, I'm talking about an average of about 480 to 500 pound bale. And I think last year's average was a little bit over 1,500 pounds of actual lent. And then out of that, you'll also get approximately 1 ton of cottonseed per acre. So,
now, is there any survey or report that's been done that'll tell us how many pairs of jeans a 450 pound bale of hay will make?
I've got that sitting here. A 480 pound bale of cotton will produce about 215 pairs of jeans.
Who knew there was so much to know about cotton? Now, being that it's an agricultural product and it's a commodity, how long can you sit on a bale? You mentioned prices were down. Will those bales go bad if you get them under some cover? Can you sit on them for a little while till the prices go up?
You can sit on them for a while. The bale is compressed, and then it's all, you know, and tied together with ties, and then there's a wrap around it to protect it from elements. But, you know, and most of it goes into a warehouse, very little open storage. There is some on years where the crop is extremely abundant, I should say. But for the most part, it goes into warehouses. Most of the Arizona crop will actually, there's a little bit of direct ship goes right over to the port of Long Beach, is put in containers and shipped overseas. But if it's not going directly until somebody buys it, it's sitting in a warehouse under protected from the weather.
What's the expected price per bale this year?
Well, we sell it by the pound. Okay, and the bales all vary. It's not an exact science. I mean, it's not like every bale comes out 480 pounds of net lent. But we sell it by the pound. Each bale's got a weight on it. There's a class on it. It's staple, which is length, color. Price is based on a lot of different things. Like I said, the length of the fiber, the staple, the fineness, the color of it, there's some and leaf content because it's in the ginning and picking process. But this year I would expect there's been some people have forward contracted some already for the upcoming harvest in the low 70s. It's kind of, you know, it's the market has fallen off a little bit the last week, and there's been some cotton that's been contracted in the 72, 73 cent range a pound. And this past week, you're probably somewhere closer to 70 cents a pound is what you could get for it.
And where is our cotton used for? Is it good enough quality you could put it into your jeans?
It's good enough quality, but I think most of the cotton in Arizona is the quality, the color that we get here, the fiber length and the strength. Most of it goes overseas. For the most part, it goes into the Pacific Rim countries and Indonesia, Vietnam, Korea, China for some of the finer wovens. But there is some that goes into denim production. I remember one time I was on a tour in the Carolinas, and I was in a denim mill where they were actually just manufacturing denim. And much to our surprise, there was a pail of cotton from Arizona in the in their warehouse. Last summer, I was in Indonesia with Cotton Council International, who's a world marketing organization for the Arizona or for the cotton industry. And we were in a mill in Vietnam, and I remember seeing bales there that were from America. So it gets around.
Now, you had shared some stats when we were talking yesterday about the amount of bales we produce versus how much we consume versus how much we export. Run through those numbers because it's very fascinating.
Yeah, basically, and I don't know how current these numbers are, but in the United States of America, America consumes about 21 million bales of cotton and durable goods, clothing and towels and sheets and whatever it can we can weave it into. And we only produce about 18 million bales a year in the United States. The other thing is we only have the spinning equivalent of about 4 million bales of spinning equipment in the United States. So for the most part, we are a major exporter of cotton. Most of it goes overseas. Some goes into Mexico, a little bit into Europe, but for I'd say a big percentage of it's going into Southeast Asia, spun into yarn and turned into fabric and into durable goods and then shipped back.
Well, Paco, I can't thank you enough. What's the name of your farm?
Tierra Verde Farms.
Tierra Verde Farms. And you are the current president of the Arizona Cotton Growers Association?
Yes, sir. I've been there since March of 16 and got about another 9 months, not quite, until my term will be up.
Well, Mr. Alteron, I cannot thank you enough for your time this Saturday morning. I know you're busy. I know you were traveling. And the education on cotton in Arizona as well as an industry as a whole. It's Rosie on the House with you every Saturday morning on this Father's Day weekend. Stay tuned. We've got more giveaways coming up in the 9 and 10 o'clock hours. And we've got one more segment with Jay Harper of Harper's Nursery finishing up our landscape and garden topic for the Outdoor Living Hour. It's Rosie on the House with you every Saturday morning. Old times there are not forgotten. Those fertile fields are never far away. Welcome back to Rosie on the House. One more, if you're just joining us, let me thank Paco Olerton one more time, the president of the Cotton Growers Association here in Arizona. That's quite fascinating. I didn't realize that cotton was, I knew it was one of the five C's, but I didn't realize just how big in a lot of those statistics. And your 3-4 year generation of Arizona and nursery and growing, have y'all ever dabbled in cotton, Jay?
Well, not personally, but my grandfather, my mom's dad and his brother farmed cotton in the Coolidge, Florence area many, many years ago. Yeah. Yeah. So got lots of ties to cotton.
Now, reading one of my outdoor trade magazines, this is the Arizona Nursery Association Southwest Horticulture. I saw in here they had a press release congratulating a gentleman at Farmer's Choice on a proud new grandfather, but it says Jay Harper. They got your company name wrong here.
Well, we're branching out. I tried to think of a clever way to say that, but branching out into, I'm starting to do some fertilizer sales for the Hickman family. You know, they sell two things that come out of the back end of a chicken.
The eggs we get at the store.
Eggs, you see, everybody knows about Hickman's eggs. And a lot of people don't realize that then they take the chicken manure and make several different fertilizer products with that. It's very popular in the golf course industry. A lot of our big farmers, our big organic vegetable farmers here use it.
And I know I've talked to Clint over the years. They've always tried to struggle to get it bagged into the consumer market, but it sounds like they're breaking into that pretty well.
We're breaking into that. We've got a really cool 15-pound plastic sealable tub. So if you're concerned about odor, you can put it right in the garage and not have a problem with it. There's a lot of great options out there. And believe me, if guys that grow the lettuce that you eat and the carrots and all the good veggies and citrus believe in it, it'll do wonders in your vegetable garden at home.
And do you get the chicken manure smell with it?
You do.
Okay.
You do. It's it is what it is. And, you know, so it is, however, heat treated, so it's pathogen free. There are no, you know, harmful pathogens or bacterias in it, so you don't need to worry about getting E. coli or something like that from it. The old notion that chicken manure is hot, well, people in the old days that just took chicken manure out of the coop and threw it on their plants, it's pretty hot when it's not dehydrated and it's wet and raw like that. These products are turned and windrowed and dried, and then in the case of the products we sell to the home gardener, they're heat treated, so they're pathogen free, and then they're put into a pellet form, so they're easy to broadcast and use. They're OMRI certified. Those folks that are into organics know what that is, and they also have a food safety certificate.
Well, I know they have, what, 6 million chickens, so they got to have
like
a
13 million.
13
You're about,
million.
That's about half.
How much fertilizer, quote, does a chicken produce a day? I know they'll do an egg a day. How much fertilizer is that?
Well, it's about, you know, about a pound a month. So a pound of pound of fertilizer a month per chicken.
Okay, a month.
So, yeah, not a day. Wow. about a pound a month. So that's still 13 million pounds a month of chicken manure that's produced.
That's pretty incredible. What a great, there's not a lot of industries where you get two for one that way.
Right. You know, and actually they do a lot of other recycling on other products too, but there's not a lot of things that get thrown in the garbage at Hickman's.
Excellent. Recapping for this broadcast, it's hot. Watch your plants. After 110, all bets are off. We've got, according to the news, 119 in Phoenix, 120. Wow. That puts Tucson in the over 110 as well.
You know, it puts Payson and Prescott at 100 degrees or a little over, you know, probably 100 and maybe 104 or 5.
Woo.
Even there, probably 90s in Flagstaff. So it's going to be hot. The whole state is really going to be hot unless you're maybe in Alpine or, you know, on top of the San Francisco peaks or Sunrise on top of the ski run. You know, it's probably going to be hot pretty much everywhere. So even the folks in our central and northern Arizona listening areas need to pay attention to soil moisture and watering. Of course, we always get some winds when we get these big high temperatures and high pressure areas. Wind dries things out as bad or worse than heat does. So get the mulch on the ground around your plants. Make sure your irrigation systems are working properly. Check your plants. I mean, I know we've got your irrigation on a timer and it's functioning, but when it gets that hot, sometimes you just got to run it manually again between the next time. As we talked about, it on certain plants, one day could cause them to be dead, you know. So you don't have a lot of margin for error when it gets that hot.
There's a lot of people that if they stood out at 119 degrees for one day would be dead too.
That's true. We don't encourage that.
No. Man, drink your water.
Get up early in the morning.
You need to be told that, though.
Big jug of water early in the morning. Don't go hike Squaw Peak at noon. You know, I mean, don't go out and try and dig a hole and plant a shade tree at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Do that stuff. It's plenty light at 5 in the morning these days. Get up and get her done early.
And you're off to Harper's Nursery on Hayden Road, south of Thomas?
That's correct. 2529 North Hayden Road, and we're just south of Thomas. And we've got a lot of heat-tolerant shrubs, and there's no problem planting them. And if they're sitting out there in the nursery in a black plastic pot getting baked, they're going to be a lot happier if you take them home and put them in the ground.
Still time to get a little summer flower color in?
Yeah, there's lots of stuff. Vinca and moss rose and pentas and angelonia, and there's a great selection. Again, lantana, ruellia, bougainvilleas, lots of good heat-tolerant, blooming, colorful plants.
Thank you, Mr. Harper. Coming up next, Open Line Hour. Get on the line now, 1-888-767-4348.
Gardening and home improvement advice, as well as special offers and discounts you can't find anywhere else. That's RosieOnTheHouse.com.